First, when President Trump tweeted that four congresswomen who have spoken out against him should leave the U.S. and go back to the countries they came from, members of the alt-right, white supremacists, and other extremists celebrated. The Anti-Defamation League rounded up some of their responses, including favorable tweets from neo-Nazi and website publisher Andrew Anglin, alt-right leader Richard Spencer, white supremacist organizer Augustus Invictus, and Matt Parrett, who used to lead the white supremacist Traditionalist Worker Party. Our next guest has been looking into the ways alt-right ideology has been moving through American culture and politics before and now during the Trump administration. Alexandra Minna Stern leads the Sterilization and Social Justice Lab at the University of Michigan, where she's a professor of American culture, history, and women's studies. She's the author of the new book, Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate: How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. Alexandra, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I want to dig first into a couple of terms that'll be coming up a lot today, I think. Alt-right and alt-light. Before we get into your book, could you explain how we define roughly these two groups?
Well, alt-right is that large umbrella term for a range of different movements on what they like to call increasingly the dissident right. Many on the alt-right have abandoned that term because it kind of lost some of its cachet after Charlottesville and other incidents. But the alt-right broadly encompasses white nationalists, white supremacists, neo-Nazi, and also misogynistic and anti-feminist movements all under one kind of unwieldy umbrella. And the alt-light tends to be those provocateurs, often on social media, who are not necessarily or not explicitly on the white nationalist bandwagon, but express many of the same sentiments around animus towards feminism, towards liberalism, towards globalism, often code word for, you know, Jewish influence. And they have both a fractious and a synergistic relationship between the two. So the alt-light are often more prominent. They'll dabble in conspiracy theories. They'll have more followers on Twitter. But there are those that shuffle back and forth, and particularly the ideas and memes are popular, like in what we might call the alt-verse, move between these two blurred sides.
And that's the focus of your book, not so much the individuals or the timeline here, but the ideas, the themes, and memes. Why was it important to you to dig into that element of the alt-right or whatever it calls itself now?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. Journalists and other authors have written some really excellent works to help us understand the resurgence of white nationalism. Often those look at key organizations or particular individuals to understand the trajectories of these individuals, why they were compelled by certain ideas to do personality profiles. And, you know, there's good journalistic storytelling that revolve around people and their particular stories and inclinations. But what I really wanted to do with this book was to understand the ideas behind the alt-right, and particularly the extent to which are these old, you know, kind of, is this new wine in old bottles, you know, these types of questions. And also to understand, you know, how has political and cultural discourse changed in American society really in a fairly short amount of time? It might have been a long time in coming, but over the past 3 or 4 years, we have seen a shift where both certain terms are recognizable, and as you mentioned at the opening of, you know, our discussion, you know, the president is tweeting basically an anti-diversity, you know, an anti-feminist tweet, which resonates with, you know, the alt-right. So I'm very interested in thinking about where we are as a society in terms of what kind of discourse we're using and the harms that can come with that discourse.
You mentioned old wine in a new bottle, and you also study this kind of rhetoric, these kind of ideas from a century and longer ago in American history, the idea of the United States being a race or ethnicity-based country, not an ideas or civics-based country. Can you talk about that thread and how it's reemerged?
Definitely. I mean, in a way, that was how I began working on this project. In 2015, 2016, I was aware of the emergence, you know, kind of on the sidelines of what became what came to be called the alt-right. And what I began to realize was that many of the eugenics texts and the eugenic ideas that, for example, Certain racial or minority groups are overbreeding, are over-fecund. They are diluting, you know, the white race. These ideas were resurfacing and being taken up with great gusto by alt-writers and white nationalists. And in fact, some of the key authors from, you know, 100 years ago, like Madison Grant and Lothrop Stoddard and some of the other really key figures that were part of eugenic racism are being celebrated actively by white nationalists. They celebrate their birthdays. They like to dip back into their ideas and repurpose them. So I wanted to understand what was at play with that and to put it in the context of the contemporary moment. And I'll just add that I'm trained as a historian, so my previous work has really used archival materials, you know, basically old pieces of paper that you find in boxes and, you know, storage units that a lot of people don't look at. And this project was different because my archive, so to speak, a lot of it was – it's all born digital material, including, you know, social media sites as well as publications and kind of what we might call the intellectual canon, you know, of the alt-right literati. So I delved into that to really write what I, you know, hope is a kind of critical history of the present and this particular moment, just to better understand it and to put it in context.
Talking to Alexandra Minna Stern about her book, Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. Well, if these ideas of a race-based nation are the old wine, the internet, I guess, is the new bottle. How has the online world, the social media world, changed the way these ideas are spread?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's played a critical role. On the other hand, we don't want to overstate the role that it's played. So on the one hand, social media provided, you know, a network and a set of interlocking platforms for memes to be developed, for ideas to ricochet around in a way that was kind of particular to the alt-right, especially in its kind of more effective phase around, let's say, the 2016 Trump election, where Pepe the Frog was bouncing around the internet and was being, you know, ironically used by those on the dissident right or the alt-right, whichever term we want to use. And so social media really helped people find each other. It also provided cover insofar as, you know, social media is a place where people can have anonymous identity. They can use aliases and avatars. And so there was a real sense, though, that you know, there was a frenzy of meme culture, let's say, that was worked to the advantage of the alt-right. Since Charlottesville and, you know, awareness of, you know, a group like the Proud Boys and kind of the riots they've been involved in, there's been deplatforming and demonetization of some of these internet celebrities. So we know, for example, Alex Jones, Gavin McGinnis, who I just mentioned, and others, they've been completely deplatformed, partially deplatformed, taken down for 24 hours or maybe a week. But one of the things that's, you know, kind of interesting and I think important to keep an eye on is that, you know, all of this has happened too little too late. You know, the internet was an ideal space for many of these groups to spread content and to proliferate content, and algorithms often worked in their favor until Facebook and other social media companies started looking at them. So that's one thing, is definitely the social media has played an integral role. It's been crucial to what, you know, is called red pilling, you know, kind of and just amplifying their message. On the other hand, you know, it's not all social media. You know, there are real life networks of groups and organizations in the United States, but also in Europe and other parts of the world. And I think it's important, you know, when thinking about this kind of, you know, old, you know, new wine, old bottles, or whatever metaphor we want to use, that, you know, the alt-right is part of a transnational phenomenon where we're seeing the similar rise of authoritarianism and national populism in countries as different as Brazil, Hungary, Sweden, Italy, other parts of the world. And the alt-right really sees itself as connected to this international wave of the rise of nationalism. And so I think it's really important to keep track of that as well.
We're talking to Alexandra Minna Stern, professor at the University of Michigan. Her new book is Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about her research? Do you see these ideas, these memes, maybe if you're online from the alt-right popping up in your social media feeds? Do you respond? How so? How do others respond? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Alexandra Minna Stern about her new book, Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the rise of the alt-right? Do you think it's been blown to some extent out of proportion? What have you seen in your social media feeds, if anything, and what questions do you have for our guest about her research? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alexandra, there is, as you mentioned, some tension, some range within the views of these groups. A very common theme, though, seems to be a fear that there is something significant called the white race. The definition has changed over time, and that it's under threat because of diversity. Can you talk about that as one of the central ideas?
That definitely is one of the core ideas, is that, first of all, there something called the white race actually exists, that it is under threat from changing demographics in American society. So one of these things that these disparate groups that we might put under the broad umbrella of the alt-right share is really a sense of demographic crisis that, you know, the connected to projections about the changing composition of the American population, to one that we know around mid-century, given census projections, you know, we will become an ethno-racial plurality in the United States. White nationalists are often clanging the bell, thinking about that midpoint of the century and trying to, you know, as they would put it, raise consciousness among whites to protect themselves and to be ready for becoming what they think they will become, which is a persecuted minority. So that definitely, and it's kind of, if anyone is familiar with the kind of discourse around white minority status in South Africa, it's very similar to that. There are resonances in terms of the language and the kind of the fear, the ideas of fear around that.
And also gender is a very common theme, and relations between men and women, and a revulsion and a stated revulsion towards transgender people as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is one of the kind of key, one of the main focuses in my book, is that I really want to show that white nationalism is not just about race. It's just as much about gender and sexuality. Core to white nationalism is, you know, it's this aggrieved white male entitlement that contains a heavy dose of misogyny, of anti-feminism, to some extent homophobia, although that varies from quarter to quarter, but most certainly transphobia. And I think it's a very interesting question to ask, why is the alt-right and also the alt-light for that matter, if we take those, you know, use those terms, why are they both so transphobic? I think part of it has to do with this fear of loss of order. I mean, if there's anything that provides order, it's a strict gender binary, and it's a strict cisgender binary where, you know, men are men and have male genitalia and women are women and they have female genitalia. That's why among some white nationalists, they're less concerned with gay people, because it's about sexual preference, not about gender identity. And so there's something deeply destabilizing about gender identity and about trans identity, about gender fluidity. And so that is really something that is quite, you know, a violent sentiment that's at the core of contemporary white nationalism.
You mentioned that idea. It's traditionalism in a lot of ways. Can you talk about the nostalgia for a past that may not have existed as envisioned?
Definitely. I mean, I think that that discussion of gender and thinking about traditional gender roles and traditionalism in, you know, more broadly, where, you know, there are fantasies. I mean, you can read white nationalism as a great fantasy of both returning to this nostalgic past that never was, usually, you know, pinpointed about 1960s America, when America was about 90% white. You know, when Leave It to Beaver was on TV, when there were, you know, families moving to the suburbs, there was obviously, you know, the height of racial segregation. I mean, that's kind of like the ideal time period or microcosm of what America looked like. So certainly there's that gender traditionalism and really this idea of kind of order. At the same time, there's looking towards a future, you know, in which technology is used to enhance and to kind of support white identity politics. And I'll just mention that, you know, one of the aims of my book was to really engage, you know, some of the book-linked texts that have influenced the alt-right. And many of those were written by, and they've been since translated by, those on the European New Right who started writing in the 70s and 80s and really over the past decades. And many of them take up these ideas of how to support, you know, what they would call identitarianism by both looking towards the past, towards a primordial, simpler, more traditional past, but also, you know, embracing a future in which technology is mobilized and harnessed to support, you know, white or European majorities. And so that would be, there's kind of a double-sided aspect to these fantasies of, they're nostalgic, but they're also forward-looking.
Talking to Alexandra Minna Stern about her new book, Proud Boys in the White Ethno-State, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. Oh, we asked on Facebook to people to share their thoughts. Gail writes, that she doesn't think the alt-right is spreading. She says, I think social media and news media just report on it more. So does it seem more present just because we're paying more attention, Alexandra?
Well, I do think that there is a, you know, risk of amplifying it. And my point is not to overstate its influence or, you know, say the alt-right is taking over American society. But again, to be aware of the ways in which the alt-right and, you know, other right-wing movements have shifted the field of discourse and the way in which we even talk about things and conceptualize things in American society. At the same time, I think we need to be cognizant that we're living through a moment in which, you know, there are a good number of white Americans who they certainly might not be ready to join white nationalist organizations, but, you know, feel some sympathy or some allegiance to some of the key ideas. And some of those key ideas or concerns would be that white heritage is being corroded and needs to be protected, that diversity is something that doesn't help white people. In fact, it harms them. And so if you look at polling and survey research, you know, it generally shows that about 30% of white Americans agree with those types of statements. And if you couple that with concerns about demographic change, especially leading up to the mid-century, it's just something to keep an eye on and to keep track of because, you know, it is possible that, you know, these ideas could gain more adherence. So my goal is not to amplify their ideas, but really to deconstruct them, to put them in perspective, and to track them and to be aware when they are encroaching you know, on our society and on the way we do things.
What is at stake if these ideas spread and don't get countered along the way?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of it has to do with the media environment and the political environment. And so, you know, it's interesting, again, to think about President Trump's tweets as, you know, he's kind of abandoned dog whistles. He made a very racist statement, which I would say resonates with some of the kind of key beliefs of white nationalism around concerns of diversity and the idea that who belongs in America and who doesn't belong in America, you know, and those types of questions. I think what we risk is, you know, more political polarization, more political strife, racial animosity. And, you know, we know that some people are incited by, you know, this type of language and, you know, these types of statements to actually enact violence. So there is, you know, a real element of potential harm there.
I want to talk for a few moments about members of the alt-right trying to distance themselves from being viewed as full-on neo-Nazis, either by distinguishing their views or behaviors or by taking an ironic stance, saying, we said that, that was just a joke. Can you take a couple minutes as we wrap up to tackle that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think you've identified two of the key trends. One is, you know, this has been going on for, you know, several generations of white nationalists, this, you know, sense that they wanted to distance themselves from swastikas or, you know, Ku Klux, you know, the hoods of the Ku Klux Klan and so on, to become more normalized, to become more sanitized, to become more appealing to mainstream America. That certainly is the case among many white nationalists today, not all, but, you know, some of the more prominent and one could say the more effective in terms of gaining adherence and having some visibility as they've normalized their image and have embraced a kind of fashy, almost European-style image. That's one thing. On the other hand, and this is why it's so slippery and it's so hard to report on this from a scholarly or journalistic perspective, is there's always this aspect of irony and plausible deniability that's connected to the kind of the meme culture of the alt-right, where someone can, you know, post something and then back off and say, well, that was really a joke, or, you know, I meant it in this way. So there's like multiple flips, you know, around, you know, using things, using memes and other images sardonically. And I think that rather than actually trying to, it's a losing battle to try to fully understand it or nail that down in an objective way. It's better to think of it as this is the kind of media ecosystem in which we're living, and that will help us get a handle on how things like Pizzagate can happen and how that can then feed back into at least some, you know, some aspects of the alt-right. So it's, you know, it's kind of learning more about actually what like trolling culture is and what, you know, what social media culture is at the same time that, you know, we keep tabs on how the alt-right seeks to normalize itself.
We'll leave it there. Alexandra, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Alexandra Minna-Stern, University of Michigan professor, author of the new book Proud Boys and the White Ethno-State, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination.